This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Professor Bart Lotsma is a historian, critic and curator in the fields of architecture, design and the visual arts. An educator and writer as well, Bart is the guest speaker for this month's public lecture by Pertubuhan Architect Malaysia, or PAM. He joins me now to discuss his work and to explain how electrification might take command in the future of design work. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
How long have you been an architecture critic, and how did you get started?
Well, in preparation of this interview, I realized that I've been an architecture critic for 35 years now, which is embarrassing to say. That's how long it is.
What made you get started in the field?
Well, I studied architecture in the late 1970s and 80s. I studied in Eindhoven in the Netherlands, not in Delft. And basically, when we graduated, there was no work. There was a big financial crisis, so most of my students disappeared. I was doing exhibitions. I got the opportunity to do exhibitions and to start. Because of that, I started writing for small text, and then I was invited to write for a cultural magazine in Eindhoven, where I wrote about art because there was nothing in architecture going on. And that's how I kept writing. And then I was very lucky. Because in Eindhoven, that was at the time, it was the seat of Philips, which is now somewhere else. These companies have diffused. And that meant that I found by accident the archives of a building by Le Corbusier, of which people knew nothing about, the Philips Pavilion at the Expo. And so I got all kind of opportunities because of that. And after that, I was first unemployed, and then I got the opportunity to teach and to continue writing. So that's what I've been doing, and I've never been really an architect.
Considering that you kind of started out writing about art, how is writing about architecture, how does it differ from writing about art?
In the period I was writing about art, it was a period in which art withdrew in the museum again, particularly in Eindhoven. Rudy Fuchs was the director there, who was very much a protagonist of that idea. And I think that shaped my idea about writing about architecture and art in the beginning. So we would try to consider also architecture as a form of art. It was a period in which that was possible because very little was built. And then in the course of the 1980s, and particularly in the 1990s, that changed. We didn't want it anymore. We realized that we would exclude ourselves from society by doing that as an architect. And that as an architect, it's absolutely central that your buildings have a role in society. So you have to be informed about what goes on. You have to form yourself an idea about what goes on. And you have to reflect on that and formulate it in an architectural idea. So that was a big change. And today I would say that art is much more about a discourse in art. Also, of course, and artists are free to choose if they go autonomous or if they address society, which artists today do a lot. And architecture, you always have to deal with society. And as the society is developing and changing faster than ever before, that becomes an even bigger challenge.
One of the ongoing conversations that we keep having about architecture is the changing nature of architecture, you know, whether the role of the architect is changing, in response, I suppose, to different environments, in response to different needs. How has your role as an architecture critic changed in concert with all this? You know, does it change along with this conversation?
Yes, absolutely. Let's say in the 1980s, history became really important for an architectural critic. It still is, the history of architecture. But in the 1980s, that was particularly because of postmodernism. So you would have to know your classics and be able to play with them. And nowadays, you have to form yourself an idea and also inform your audience, whether it is architects or also a wider audience, about the changes in the context in which architecture is produced. Whether it is about real estate, whether it's about technological changes, about sociological changes. And what happens in architecture is, of course, always informed by that and also limited by that. It's channeled by that. So that is what you would have to do these days. And absolutely, that is a new role also for the critic.
Considering all these different, fountains of knowledge you have to go through, what would you say are the foundations of good architectural criticism?
Today it is both. You have to know the history of architecture, of course, and that has to do with the fact that you have to be able to figure out for yourself, because a critic hopefully writes about buildings that have not been published yet and about architects that have not been published yet. So you have to be able to form yourself an idea about the quality of it, and then the reference is, of course, largely the architectural history. At the same time, you have to inform your audiences, as I said, about the context in which it is produced, and the context not only in which it is produced, but basically the context that produces this architecture.
How can a critic help someone who is not in the architecture field see and appreciate their environment?
I would say first by best practice examples. That is always, there are always some architects, and whether it's not just architects, it's also bakers or doctors or journalists or critics that are better than others and more intelligent than others, or have more talent than others. I don't know what it is, and so, and that is of course always the challenge to reach that level, and they can also produce ideas that others can work with. So it is important to show best practice examples, but at the same time, you have to show people what the limits are or what the forces are that shape it.
You were and are a member of several governmental, semi-governmental, municipal committees in different countries. Could you tell me about some of the projects you've had and you're currently working on?
Yes, in the Netherlands, committees are really important. Everything is decided to committee through committees. Subsidies are divided through committees. But also, let's say, until the late 90s, there was a very active policy making, also cultural policy making. So in the Netherlands, I've been doing two things. One was the Amenities Committee in Arnhem, in which you basically played almost the role of a kind of advising on urbanism and urban planning. And that was a very interesting period because Arnhem, from a very poor city, became a rich city and was growing. So that was quite interesting, also introducing interesting architects like Ben van Berkel and Ewan Studio there. But on the other hand, I was also in a crown member of the Cultural Council in the Netherlands, in which you advise the ministers and the queen on all cultural issues and cultural policies. That was also interesting. Nowadays, that is very different. I'm now in Austria, and these committees do not have the same status there. But at the moment, I'm working on a project in Montenegro, which is about a big saline, which is crucial for migrating birds, and which doesn't work anymore, which goes bankrupt. So we invited architects to make plans for that so that it can continue working and continue being an important biotope for birds. A book of mine is coming out, so those are very different kind of projects. Oh, yeah, and I'm on the committee, of course, of the IBA, the International Building Exhibition in Vienna, that just starts, which is about public housing. So that will run until 2022. We just started, but that is also a committee that I'm on, yes.
Is it important to you as a critic, you know, to be able to, or how important, rather, I should say, is it for you to be culturally aware, you know, because the projects that you're describing aren't necessarily, I mean, they're definitely about architecture, but they also involve so many other things. They involve, you know, ecology. They involve understanding how animals, you know, do things. They involve understanding how different countries work. You know, things in Austria are not the same as they are in Netherlands. How important is it for you to keep yourself informed, and how much information do you need to have?
Oh, that's a very good question, and that is an enormous change also in my profession, because also as a critic, architecture used to be nation-based. Also critics, of course, were nation-based. And since the 1990s, incredible process of globalization, internationalization have started. So you have to be culturally aware about the state of the art. But every time you also have to be able to dive into this specific context. And that is very difficult. And it's also something, to be honest, that I would like to have take some time to reflect upon longer. Of course, it's something that we're all struggling with. Even if we're not moving, we're suddenly living in a globalized world. I've just been in a cafe in Banksar, which could also be in Italy or France or Vancouver. So you see that these issues are playing a role for all of us, basically.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking today with Professor Bart Lotsma, historian, critic, and curator in the fields of architecture, design, and the visual arts. We're talking about his work. Up next, we find out a little bit more about Dutch architecture. You're listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Joining me in the studio, Professor Bart Lotsma, historian, critic, and curator in the fields of architecture, design, and the visual arts. He's here as part of PAM's public lecture series, and we've been discussing the work that he does. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Dutch architecture was propelled into the limelight by the success of Rem Koolhaas. Would you agree with that?
Partly. As in, Dutch architecture became important in the 20th century. For many reasons. Before Rem came back to the Netherlands, because he went away, it was in a crisis. So I would say that Rem revitalized it, also by connecting to certain traditions. Rem's grandfather was already an important architect in the Netherlands, working for the government, doing huge buildings. So Rem was very well informed also about how Dutch architecture worked. And he took that very seriously. So I would say that he revitalized it. And he had an incredible influence by doing that.
I'm curious about that phrase when you say he understood how Dutch architecture worked. So I don't understand how that works. You know, how would you describe Dutch architecture?
Well, for many people, I think Dutch architecture is about old houses and canals and windmills. But beyond that, about 90% of the Dutch environment is from after the Second World War. So that is very recent. So that was a period with an incredible growth of the population and also with new technological developments. So Dutch architecture is largely about an engineer's tradition dealing with water. You have to create every landscape in which you build. So all landscapes are artificial. So urbanism starts with the landscape, with an engineering tradition of the landscape, and with urban planning. And from 1901 on, urbanism and public housing were immediately linked. So that also means that architects were constantly gathering ideas about this changing context in which they built. In the 1920s, the Netherlands were very afraid that they would explode like London or Berlin or Paris, which was very frightening for people at the time. And then they started calculating the needs of the population. Now, basically, that is something that Rem is still doing. He was very informed by that mentality, so he's still doing research now on a global level. But of course, this research has also changed for many reasons.
You've written extensively and published a book back in 2002 called Super Dutch, which featured key figures in Dutch architecture. Who did you feature and why did you select them?
Oh, that's already a long time ago. We selected OMA, of course, with Rem Koolhaas, MVRDV. We selected at the time Meccano, UN Studio, Ben van Berkel, Knox, Cas Oosterhuis. That is an interesting question because it's already a long time ago. The intriguing thing is that Knox, for example, does not exist even anymore.
At the time, did you select them based on, the quality of work that had been done, the scope of work that had been done? I mean, what were the parameters of selection?
The parameters of selection were basically to find offices, and indeed Rem inspired them or us to do that, that would take modernity seriously and who would formulate their own idea about modernity. First, modernity in the Netherlands, because in the beginning of the 90s it was still a very national business architecture, and then increasingly international. And so that was the most important aspect.
I've read that Dutch architecture is characterized by inventiveness, whimsy, creative use of materials, and dynamic formal experimentation. Would you agree? Does the work of Dutch architects working today reflect that?
Well, in a way it does. We build much cheaper than most other European countries, but I wouldn't say it's the essence. The reasons we build cheaper is that Dutch architects are very much dealing with the everyday and taking the everyday very seriously. Also, I would say Dutch architects are really very pragmatic, and I think that is more important than the other characterization. The other characterization is then, in the end, when it is there, what it looks like, and that is certainly true. Also the whimsiness. Sometimes I presented it to to aldermen from other countries that were really shocked how early Dutch architecture deteriorated. But I would say the pragmatic side and also the awareness that for that reason you would not be able to build with the quality standards as in Germany or Switzerland, that is, I think, the most important aspect.
When you say Dutch architects deal with the everyday seriously, where does that mindset come from, that mindset of pragmatism, of taking the everyday, you know, very seriously?
Well, in Super Dutch, I refer to the Calvinist tradition, in which, particularly in the Dutch tradition, in which you are afraid to, the English word escapes me now, to make too big plans or to make too ambitious because you would fall hard and go bankrupt. So there is always this idea of modesty, and therefore also instead of making big utopian or aesthetical or money-consuming plans, you would kind of be constantly focused on the everyday little troubles.
And one of those, some of those, you know, everyday, not little troubles at this point anymore, you know, is of course environmental, social sustainability. Are you seeing more architecture that's concerning itself with this?
Absolutely, but not enough. And of course, one of the interesting things is I think the more interesting developments are not coming from Europe at this moment anymore, but from Asia. I think of Ken Yang, but also of whole cities that are much more ambitious and that have also the opportunity to rethink it more drastically. So there's not enough. There are big challenges. I would say they're not just challenges for individual architects, but they have to be solved also on the level of norms, regulations, etc. And I think there is still a lot to do. The difference with the old norms and regulations is that nowadays these norms are much more produced by the industry than by the state, let's say, and that it's that you have to be very careful therefore by what kind of industries you have yourself led. And that makes it very difficult to solve it at a collective level at the moment. But still, I think that is much more important than individual architects working with.
Are there any particularly promising initiatives that you've seen or, you know, you've read of happening around the world that you think, yes, you know, that is how you might make living in cities more sustainable?
That is a different question, a difficult question. To be honest, I'm not so happy with it. Let's say on the one hand, you could say, yes, in Switzerland, they're very far, but that is such a rich country that you can't compare it. And of course, a big task to be much more sustainable ecologically, socially, is in the enormous growth of the population in large parts of the world, the speed by which cities have to be constructed, and that poses completely new challenges.
I know that flood control is an important issue for the Netherlands, you know, as about two-thirds of its area is vulnerable to flooding. How are the standard responses to the risk of flooding integrated into the overall architecture and landscape design there? You know, are we still talking about, I guess most people would be thinking about dikes, would be thinking about dams and things of that nature.
Of course, dikes and dams are still very important. But the flood control, let's say, is such an old issue that it is actually a part of our democracy. We don't just have a national, a provincial and a local level in democracy, but we also have the so-called the level of water, which is also where people also are elected. So it is not just building things, it's also really something that you organize as a society. Dikes are still incredibly important, and they're still being built. It is also about dealing with the side effects of these dikes, because certain parts of the Netherlands, the water dies because of these dikes. There are parts of the also artificial landscapes giving back to nature. But the most important threat or a new threat is the water from the rivers, the River Rhine notably and the River Meuse that come from, let's say, Germany and France to the Netherlands. And because of the global warming, these rivers produce new floods. Not just the global warming, it's also the way how these countries like Germany deal with their water so that they come into this river very quickly, too quickly, and then suddenly whole parts of the Netherlands are flooded. That is a new problem and that you can't solve with dikes. So there are experiments with, on the one hand, you give parts of the land back to nature. On the other hand, people live there. So there are also a kind of experiments with amphibious dwelling.
How should architects engage with the issue of climate change, which is, you know, clearly affecting all of us?
It's affecting all of us, and therefore it is in the first place a collective issue. So most of these things you traditionally as a government organized by regulations, by laws, in tax incentives, and so on. I think in the production of these laws and regulations, architects could play a bigger role than they do now. Of course, individual architects can produce projects that can be presented as a kind of best practice, but that is not enough. So architects are always very depending on one hand, the industry, on the other hand, the regulations, because their clients will also kind of be depending on all those factors.
I read this somewhere. Modern architecture has become predictable, represented by indistinguishable corporate work, ego-driven monstrosities that litter the physical and cultural landscape. Big words. Would you agree?
Yes. Over the last couple of years, that has become an increasingly important and problematic issue. On the other hand, that also has to do with the fact that, let's say, the things we publish globally and the things that appear globally nowadays, not in magazines but on websites, are largely produced by these people. So you have gotten a kind of star system. This star system, however, comes to an end now. And if you're look at it in a more relaxed way, it is a minor part of the environment that these people build. What is the problem is that these people take away the sight at all the other projects and the real issues that are at stake in architecture.
And that contributes in some ways to another tendency, which is to build icons, which is something I think you see in cities around the world, whether or not they're new cities or old cities, new buildings, old buildings. Do you see that happening a lot? How do you feel about this idea of iconic buildings?
Well, it has become really important. I'm currently writing a book on a new icon and building that is completing of $1.5 billion dollars in Saudi Arabia. And there this iconic aspect, and they even call it an icon, even if that is a Catholic or a Christian Orthodox word, basically. And they even call that building an icon, and it has to do with the fact that they want to be globally perceived. And an iconic building, also we have in Innsbruck, we have a cable car designed by Zaha Hadid, which takes, I think, 60 people up the mountain, so that's very little. But it paid itself back, if I'm correct, in half a year's time, because it is an aspect of city marketing. So these icons do not just work on the spot, but they work in the media. And in that sense, they can be also be very effective, yes.
Do you feel that buildings, whatever their purpose, whatever their form, do end up carrying political baggage?
Of course. But in the first place, on a very basic level, let's say architecture is, of course, well, it gives shelter. But the next thing is that it says what is yours and what is mine, what is private and what is public, who owns what land, it defends your property, etc., etc. It makes sure that your building doesn't take away the sun or the view of my building, etc., etc. So that those are all very political decisions. And they are political because they are not work on the spot, but there has to be a kind of equality of justice everywhere. So from that moment on, it very early on brings the architecture discourse on a kind of very general level and not just on the level on the spot.
As you say, I think you've kind of made that point about, you know, other discussion points as well about how it's a systemic thing, ultimately, mm-hmm. and not necessarily the work of individuals or even individual communities. You're delivering a talk titled Electrification Takes Command this evening, which, from what I understand, intends to touch on developing modes of operative criticism to set an agenda for future design work. Could you elaborate? What does that mean?
Yes, that is something that is very dear to me and that I try to do in Austria as well, to figure out the topics that would be interesting or important for students to work with, let's say, in their practice when they get their own practice in 10, 15, 20 years' time from now. And so this is one of the issues. Electrification takes command, the role of the computer, artificial intelligence. Also, architects will become superfluous very soon because of this. So how does that really work, not just on the level of building parts, on the level of networks, also for the profession, and in general for our view of what humans are?
What are some future projects that you're working on? You know, once you leave our shores, you return to Austria, what do you have lined up?
Well, at the moment, I'm in the last phase of correcting the proofs for my book, Reality Bites, which will come out in the next two or 3 months, which is a collection of essays of the last 20 years. Then I'm working on a very exciting project, which is a former saline in Montenegro, which it went bankrupt because salt is not worth anymore what it used to be worth. And at the same time, this saline, which is completely man-made and looks completely abstract, even more artificial than the Dutch landscape, has become an important tank station, gas station for birds on the way from Europe and Siberia to Africa and Asia. So if this doesn't work anymore as a saline, they don't pump up water, and with this water, the food for these birds is pumped up, so that where they feed on. So if it doesn't exist anymore, millions of birds will die. And so we invited three offices to work on that, to make project for that, and that will be exhibited at the Venice Biennale this year. So that is a very exciting project. The other project that just started is the International Building Exhibition in Vienna, which is about public housing and largely about social sustainability.
You can catch Bart's lecture today, the 17th of February, at the Black Box in Publica at Solaris, Jalan Dutamas 1 KL. Reception and registration begins from 7 p.m. The lecture itself starts at 7:45. Admission's free. It's on a first-come, first-served basis. For more information, you can visit PAM, that's PAM.org.my. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
I've been speaking with Professor Bart Lootsma, historian, critic and curator in the fields of architecture, design and the visual arts. And we've been discussing architecture and the work that Bart has done. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.